Welcome back to Ask the Compound Show, where each week we get dozens of emails from our audience, all asking questions about personal finance, investing, markets, Duncan's hats, Ben's fashion tips, and we answer them on this show. AskTheCompoundShow@gmail.com is our email. Email us in here. We were supposed to have a guest on today's show. They got sick. Solo Ben and Duncan show today. The show must go on. So we emptied out the inbox today. There's been a bunch of stragglers that have been sitting there for a while. I emptied it out. And we also want to take a bunch of questions from the live audience. And I'm going to do like a lightning round at the end. So if you're in the chat today live, shoot us a question. We'll pull it up at the end. Today's show, we're talking about, did indexing kill small and mid-cap stocks? How do you determine the difference between luck and skill in investing? How do you convince your spouse to make better financial decisions? Should you pay off that mortgage if it's 6 to 7%? When it makes sense for young people to move to a high cost of living city? And then how to invest in the housing market outside of buying a house?
Yeah, we got a good one today. And it's March Madness, so a lot to be excited about.
We're going to be done just in time for people to watch the end of the games. Today's show is sponsored by the Compound Newsletter. So we get a weekly wrap of all the Compound content because we do a lot here. We know we do. Not everyone can keep up with everything. We give new merch drops. A couple weeks ago, I got the Compound Newsletter in my email, and I saw the white hoodie for the Compound. I said, wait, Nicole, I don't have one of these. Send me one of these. I'll wear it on the show.
Yeah.
I forgot about that one.
We mix it up. We change things in the shop pretty regularly.
Yep. Yeah. New TCAF guest is listed there a week early. Live events, all kinds of stuff you can see. It's thecompoundnews.com/subscribe. Send us your email. We'll send you a bunch of stuff. It's great. Plus, new subscriber each week will win something.
Yeah. So this week, actually, we have someone that I'll be emailing here shortly. JB, based on their email, it looks like is their name maybe. So congrats, JB, and I'll be sending you an
free
email.
Compound merch.
Yeah.
All right, we got a lot of questions. Let's do it.
All right. Up first today, we have a question from John. Lots of podcasts have discussed how large cap indexes just keep going up and that maybe that's pushing PE ratios too high from people buying index funds. At the same time, mid and small cap indices have not seen the same overall growth. Is there a risk to the S&P 500 gets out of hand relative to true value and the market falls as everyone exits at once? And I have two like asides to that one. Did we establish in the past the difference between indexes and indices? Because they use both in the same paragraph.
If you're in Great Britain, you can say indices. If you're in the United States, you get to say indexes. That's the difference. You have to have an accent if you want to say indices.
Okay. I like indices personally, but yeah.
It sounds better, but you have to have an accent. That's the rule. Sorry.
Okay.
I've always thought the worries about index funds were overblown because if all the money flowing into index funds is propping up stock prices, why is it that large cap stocks have been doing better than small and mid cap stocks? Wouldn't it be easier to push up the prices of small and mid sized companies? That would seem to make sense. When you buy a market cap weighted index fund, you're not putting more than is already priced into the bigger stocks. You're investing in proportion to the holdings of the market itself. So, and if index funds are truly propping up these giant tech stocks, how do you explain the drawdowns they had in the 2022 bear market? So the S&P 500 was down 25% peak to trough. John, throw up the chart. Here's some of the drawdowns for Google, Nvidia, Netflix, Facebook, Apple, Tesla, down 45%, 70%, 76%, 77%, 31%, 74%. These stocks were down way more than the market itself. If index funds investors were still investing, why didn't they prop up these stocks? And why did they go down so much more than the market? So I'm not going to naively say that index funds are having no impact on the market. They obviously are, but, and I think valuation is probably a big part of it, but there's something else going on here. All right, back to small and mid caps. So these stocks have been lagging for quite a while, right? And I think a lot of investors are ready to abandon any form of diversification. Like, why would you invest outside of large cap growth stocks like the S&P 500 or even the NASDAQ 100, right? These are obviously the best companies in the world. Why would you invest in anything else? Maybe that's the case, but history has shown to be unkind to people who pour into one asset class or one segment of the market after it's had this huge run of outperformance, right? So maybe the world is different right now. And maybe, because sometimes it really is different. But, you know, what if it's all just cyclical? Because my whole thinking is markets are forever and always cyclical. John, throw up the next chart. Here's a look at some different cycle performances for small caps, mid caps, and large caps. So the S&P 600 is the small cap index. S&P 400 is a mid cap. We all know the 500 is for large caps. From the mid to late 90s, the S&P 500 destroyed small and mid caps. Makes sense. That was a dot-com bubble. A lot of big tech stocks did well. But then look at the period from 2000 to 2013. Small caps and mid caps were up 290%, 260%, while the S&P was up 64%. You had this really long run where small and mid cap stocks outperformed. Then since 2014 to 2023, the S&P 500 has outperformed by quite a bit. So I don't know, maybe it's just cyclical, right? The S&P 500 has lapped everything, but it had a period of underperformance and now it's outperformed. It's also interesting to note. So this is a 30-year period. I got these other S&P indices go to 94. Oh, shoot, I said indices. I don't have an accent.
I'm telling you, it sounds better. It sounds better. I think we're an indice show.
It rolls off the tongue. It rolls off the tongue a little easier. So the data for the S&P 400 and 600 go back to 1994. So through the end of 2023, we have 30 years of data. Here's the annual returns for each of these three segments. Small caps were up 10.2% per year. Mid caps, 11.2%. And large caps, 10.1%. So actually, over the last 30 years, the S&P 500 has underperformed small caps and mid caps, which is kind of surprising. John, throw up the next chart. You can get a kind of better sense of the cycles by looking at the valuation. So this is trailing 12-month PE ratio since 2000. You can see, okay, going into the 2000s, the S&P was very highly valued. So it makes sense that the S&P 500 underperformed for the next 14 years or whatever. Then you look at coming into the 2010s, 2011, and especially mid-caps were far more overvalued than anything else. Small caps had higher valuations than the S&P. Guess what happened? The S&P went on to underperform or outperform those ones underperformed. Now we see it changing of the guard where the S&P now has the highest valuations and small and mid caps are more reasonably valued. So that's kind of what happens in these different cycles. So I don't know that for sure this will happen, that it'll hold, but it makes sense, right? That these cycles happen where the overvalued segment of the market goes on to underperform, and then the undervalued goes on to outperform.
Also, in their question, John says, when everyone exits at once, what would be the catalyst for, you know, for there to be a mass exodus from an index fund? You know, that's the thing I was wondering.
I think that's a worry people are. Right. Where are people going to put their money? People have to put their money somewhere. That's the mass exodus thing. I mean, of course, the reason for bear markets is because people sell, but it's not like everyone literally rushes to the exit at once. And I think it's also interesting to look at the impact of big tech stocks on the S&P. So the JP Morgan Guide to the Markets has a chart. John, throw it up here. Do a chart on it for me. They break it out by the top 10 stocks versus the remaining 490 plus or whatever. And they look, and the S&P itself is trading at 20 times earnings. The top 10 stocks are trading at 30 times earnings. The remaining 490 are trading at less than 19 times earnings. And so, yes, the S&P 500 seems overvalued, but it's more like the S&P 10 that has a high valuation and the S&P 490 is more reasonably priced. Now, you could also say because the performance of these stocks has been so great, those stocks deserve a valuation premium, but how much of that success is already priced in? That's the multi-trillion dollar question, obviously. But, you know, a lot of the reason for these high valuations is because it makes sense. They're the biggest and best companies. But the question is, like, does the fact that they have higher valuations mean the returns will actually be a little lower going forward? Probably. Does this mean large caps will underperform starting tomorrow? Probably not. Does it mean small caps and mid caps automatically outperform going forward? I don't know. I'd say there's no guarantees in the market. So I don't know really what the future holds. That's why I own large caps and mid caps and small caps. So diversification is my way of admitting I don't know what's going to outperform when. But it's also a strategy that gives you the highest odds of achieving, holding the winner at any one point.
A lot of the fear about index funds or ETFs causing issues is from Michael Burry in recent years, right? Didn't he write?
Well, there's
a lot
of people. I think, unfortunately, it comes from a lot of active investors who underperformed.
Okay.
And they need someone to point to say this is why it's happening. It's the index fund. It's not me. It's not my strategy. It's everyone else. That's why, right? So, could index funds cause some weird movement in certain stocks when they get added to the index or taken away? Or could there be like these little flash crashes where the stock market falls 3% in the morning because whatever liquidity goes away? Yeah, it could happen. But over the long term, is it really going to make a difference? No, the biggest and best companies will perform the best. That's what's always happened.
Do you think when you see something like NVIDIA soaring is part of the reason that a lot of other chip stocks go along with it because the index is having to buy more, and so it's rebalancing accordingly, and so they have to buy more of the, I think, the family?
Who sets the prices in the market, the index funds or the active investors? The reason these it's the active investors. They're the ones buying, right?
Yeah.
The index funds hold the stocks in proportion to what the other active investors hold them in. That's what people don't realize. It's not like the S&P 500 is saying Apple should be 10%. No, no, no. Active investors hold 10% of Apple, so Apple makes up 10% of the market.
Okay.
Next question.
Okay, got it.
We're fired up. Someone says I'm talking with my hands more. I was in Italy for a few days. It's possible.
It's yeah, it's true. I think Cliff and I hear a little bit of an accent, too. So, yeah.
I don't want that.
Okay, so question two comes from Bill. Let's say you have an investor who purchased 10 individual stocks at the same time. Three stocks mooned and the seven other bags were made whole. Would you say the investor was skilled or that they have the illusion of skill? I feel like this one's personal, honestly, but yeah, this one kind of.
Yeah, it's either asking about themselves or a friend. Like, everyone has a friend who they know got lucky, who thinks they're a good investor. Duncan, have you read this one yet? The Success Equation by Malcolm Obison?
I have not.
Okay, put it on your list. It's okay. One of my favorite books ever written in the last 15 years or so. So the whole thing is about the paradox of luck versus skill. So John, throw my little handy chart up here. I think I created this after I read the book a long time ago for my blog. And he has this luck skill continuum. And pure luck on one end, which is slot machines, roulette. And then pure skill on the other end, which is chess. And he also has like basketball is pretty close to pure skill. Soccer, baseball's up there. Football and hockey are kind of in the middle. Because there's more, a little more luck involved. And he has markets and investing closer to the pure luck type of thing. And his whole reasoning was like, can you lose in the market on purpose? And it seems like there's some people who can, like a lot of people I feel like in the last 10 or 15 years have, but my favorite concepts in the book was the paradox of skill, which just means as participants get better at an activity, luck plays a more important role in determining who wins, right? So Ted Williams, the example he gives is Ted Williams is the last 400 hitter in the Major League Baseball. And it's kind of crazy. If you go back to the 1940s when Williams did this, the batting average for baseball players was pretty similar to today. I think the batting average is some in the range of like 250 to 270. And that's the same thing today. But back then, you had a really great hitter in Williams hitting 400 and a really crappy hitter hitting one. So it's a huge range, right, between the best and the worst. But the average was closer to today. And today, the range between the best and the worst is much narrower. And that's what you see in the markets too, right? The results between – there's no more Warren Buffetts that are just knocking the ball, cover off the ball. It's you have pretty good investors who are – the really great ones aren't much better than the really bad ones, okay? So he says the difference between saying that short-term results of investment managers are mostly luck and saying they're all luck does not hold up. Research shows that most active managers generate returns above their benchmark on a gross basis, but that those excess returns are offset by fees, leaving investors with net returns below those of the benchmark. So that's what Mobison says in the book, which makes sense. So it's not like saying all these professional investors are idiots. It's just that if you take away that the fees that they charge, it's hard to beat the market because that provides a hurdle rate. So I also think that there are fewer, getting back to the index fund thing, there are fewer suckers remaining at the poker table because so many retail investors have decided to index or target date funds or that sort of thing. So there's fewer mistakes to exploit, right? There's fewer suckers at the table. And so as like these less skilled people abandon active strategies, the remaining competition is a bunch of good investors. It's a pool of really good investors, hedge funds and portfolio managers that manage mutual funds and ETFs. And it's harder and harder on average to beat them. So John, throw up the SPIVA chart. This is the annual all fund performance versus the benchmark. You look over 10, 15, 20 years. We're talking, you know, 9 out of every 10 funds underperform the index. And this is across large caps, small caps, mid caps, growth, value, real estate, all these different fund categories. Like well over 90% of them underperform the simple index. And, you know, if you look back historically, the numbers were probably more like, yeah, you're probably top 70, like you're beating 75 to 80% of all investors in an index fund. Now it's closer to 90, 95%. So it's actually getting harder to beat index funds for the past 10, 15, 20 years. So getting back to the original question, like can anyone just pick three huge winners once? And I think the biggest question you have to ask is if you're trying to figure out luck versus skill is could you do it again? That's Mobison's whole thing is, do you have a repeatable process? Anyone can get lucky once or twice, but can you figure out? And he says that if it's closer to the luck side of continuum, a good process is really the only way to tell if it's really successful over the long run. So can you pick the best stocks consistently, not just one or two? once or twice.
Yeah, I think people discount how random a lot of the stuff that happens to a company in just the normal business cycle is, right? Like a company I won't name had like a processing facility that contaminated a bunch of their product that was a co-packer. It wasn't even like their own facility. And they ended up having to recall tons of their product. And that had a massive impact on their earnings and on their revenue.
Is this one of your holdings, Duncan?
Yes, it is. But that this was last year. But yeah,
this is just a random stock. I just heard about it.
Who would ever have thought like, oh, that's a thing that I have to account for?
Well, the other thing is, and how much of it is like, let's say that you run a purely technology fund over the last 15 years. You could have invested in anything and you would have been fine. But let's say that you happen to be someone who picked just utility stocks. And the whole segment underperformed. Are you a bad investor because you're stuck picking utility stocks, or did you just hit a bad sector? So that's the whole thing too. Is you have to understand like what it's attributable to. So it's really hard to judge because the time frames and what's doing well and what's not. It's hard to say.
Well, it's also like you guys on Animal Spirits yesterday were talking about ARK. A lot of people did amazing in ARK, right? It's all about like time frame, like when you got in, yes. When you got out. A lot of people did really well with ARK.
And unfortunately,
a lot of people lost a ton of money.
Jumped in at the end, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, next question.
All right, up next
That's a good question. It's fair.
Yeah. This one is anonymous for obvious reasons. My spouse owns and operates a successful small e-commerce business. I help out as much as I can and try to offer sound financial advice for the growing company. Over the past few years, the business has amassed a cash reserve of over $500,000. The problem is that my partner insists on keeping all of it in a checking account. The balance is used to cover hefty taxes and also serves as a six-month reserve for future expenses in case things go south. I've urged my partner to invest some of the money or put it in a high-yield savings account, but they refuse to move it. After trying to explain what a high-yield savings account is, they said it sounded like a scam. This is in part because they don't understand finances very well. What should I do? Do you often advise clients that won't take your advice?
Okay, so this is the whole optimization versus behavior, like headbutting each other. And guess which one wins? Behavior, always, over optimization. So the thing is, people make irrational financial decisions all the time to keep themselves sane. Some people hold more cash than they should because it helps them sleep at night. Some people decide to pick stocks in a portfolio that's off to in a sidecar investment for 5 or 10% because it's fun and it scratches an itch. Some people own bonds when they're young, because even though they should be holding 100% in stocks, just because they can't handle the emotional volatility. Outside of finance, people pay for a personal trainer when they should just be able to work on their own, right? So people pay for things or do things that might seem irrational on the outside. So don't approach this from the perspective of your wife being irrational, because there's obviously something going on here. Approach this from the perspective of there being some reason or experience that she's doing this. Like, how long did it take her to build this business up? If she's got a $500,000 cash buffer, the business is probably doing pretty well. Like, I'm sure there were some lean days in there and she's thinking back to those. So I think there's a couple ways that I would approach this. Number one, I would try to bring in an outside party. Have her hire a finance person to manage this. Say, you're gonna handle the books keeping and the cash management. Take it off of your wife's plate because she can handle everything else. I think you can also try to understand like what level of cash would make you feel safe. Let's figure out a percentage of revenues or a percentage of 6 months spending or whatever the number is. And then automatically when it goes above that, sweep it into a high yield savings account or money market or whatever. I also think it probably makes sense to potentially have her talk to an advisor, because odds are you trying to educate her is not going to go nearly as well as a third party who has no skin in the game trying to do this. You'll probably have a better time getting her to change behavior if it's someone else telling her to do it rather than you. That would be my initial read.
And that someone could be you right here on the show. He could just clip this and have you.
That's true. Put it in here. So again, obviously there's something in her experience that has caused her to want to have this very conservative side of things. Even if to you it makes no sense, in her mind it does make a lot of sense.
It is funny to me the idea of someone thinking that a high yield savings account sounds like a scam when we hear the opposite side so often, where people are like, oh, this crypto thing sounds totally legit. And it's like an obvious scam.
I guess if you've never really been a big investor, though, if you thought like, so wait, I'm going to hand my money to this entity and they're just going to hand me more money back.
Right. Yeah.
Because it does kind of sound like a scam.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that the entire banking system,
like Charles Ponzi.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but I would try to bring in some sort of third party That'd be my initial read here.
Yeah.
She's not going to listen to you.
I wouldn't have this be the dinner table conversation regularly.
No.
Yeah. It's not going
to
go well.
I think you have to make it more of a compliment than an insult of, listen, you've built this wonderful company on your own. Focus on that. Let someone else focus on the financial side of things. Because obviously, if you have no background in it, you're really good at e-commerce stuff. You're not very good at the financial stuff. Let someone else handle the finances.
And just to be fair, to play devil's advocate, on the side of thinking that a high yield savings account sounds like a scam, this isn't a scam. But I had two high yield savings accounts in the last year and a couple months close because they went under. And that's
tell
a huge
me the names.
Pain.
Tell us the names.
One of them was called Enzo Bank, and the other was like Zerp or something. I don't know.
The bank was called Zerp, and you didn't think it was a scam?
Hey, Baron was Davis like was an investor. Baron Davis was an investor in this company, but
name alone. All right,
but no, for real, like that
you
is
deserve
a huge
to get
pain.
Scammed.
I didn't lose any of the I didn't lose money. I actually made money on the interest, but it's just a huge pain to like have to move your money around every time a bank collapses on you. You know,
true.
Like,
go for a bigger one, even if the rate's a little lower.
Exactly.
All right. Yep. Another question.
Okay. Up next. Up next, we have a question from Matt. It was spelled with a U, to be fair.
That's even worse.
Up next, we have, what are your thoughts on paying down a new mortgage at 6.5%? We're in our late 30s, married, and have two kids, ages 2 and 4. We're aggressively saving for retirement, 25%, and our kids, 529s. We're leaving our 3% mortgage with $150,000 of cash from a sale of our house, and purchasing a new $800,000 house at 6.5% due to a job change. How do we balance paying off a mortgage at such a high percentage versus saving for retirement in 529s? For reference, our household income is currently $350,000 and 401k Roth 529s are around $900,000.
That was like a sneaky not to brag there at the end.
Yeah, I like that.
Sneak that in there.
That's good.
We probably have a dozen or so questions in our Google Doc about paying off a mortgage early, and people have different rates and such, but we've mentioned this one before, obviously. We've talked about it. But it's a topic that comes up a lot because there's so much back and forth internally when you're having this struggle to figure it out. Viewers of the show know I am not a fan of paying off a 3% mortgage. I know that never, ever, ever. I don't care about your relationship with debt. Figure it out. Don't pay your 3% mortgage off. I don't care. I get the behavioral side of things. I get it. I get that no one's ever regretted paying off a mortgage. Still don't do it. But 6.5% is a different story. Right? You're still getting some tax breaks, and a mortgage payment remains one of your best hedges against short and long-term inflation. But that's a much higher hurdle rate. So I think the circumstances matter here, though. So they said late 30s, and they have all these other goals still, right? 401k, Roth IRA, 529s, all this stuff. I'd ask yourself a few questions first. Like, for paying off the house, are you comfortable with the illiquidity putting into the house, first of all? Would you change your mind if you could refinance? Because they said they have a 3% mortgage they're sitting on, they're going to rent it out or whatever. Let's say you could refinance at 6.5% to 4.5% in a couple years because we have a recession and the Fed lowers rates and mortgage rates fall. Would that change your mind at all? If you had to refinance and then you paid it off for why? You know, for a couple years worth of didn't do much. And then the biggest question is why pay it off in the first place? To what end, right? Is it because you hate debt? Is it because you've run the cost-benefit analysis? Is it because you want to retire early? Especially, I think, in your late 30s, like, what's the end game? Is it to get rid of that payment? Because if the whole point is to get rid of the payment and then take the payment savings and then save those, well, you could just be saving whatever you'd be paying off early for the mortgage. So it kind of defeats the purpose. So the house, when you have your money in the house, it just kind of sits there. So I think it really, it's always a matter of personal preference. 6.5% does seem high. But I think you have to ask yourself, like, a few of these questions of, like, why are we doing it in the first place? Is it because you're just trying to figure out the hurdle rate? Like, I could get 8% in stocks over the next 10 years, but that 5.5% is guaranteed. The 8% is not. I would just kind of try to understand what's the point. And the other thing is, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You could pay a little bit extra. Run the numbers on that. You can do a loan amortization thing in Excel and figure out if we made an extra $100 a month, $200 a month, $500, whatever the number is, how many years is it really going to take off the mortgage? And is it worth it?
You're speaking from experience here, right? Didn't you say one time that you were making early payments or extra payments on your mortgage?
My first mortgage rate was like 6.5% like this, and I refinanced 3 times probably. And I went down to 5%, then I went down to 4%. And every time I just kept my payment similar. So even though the payment should have been lower, I kept it the same. But then we sold the house 10 years later, and I realized, oh yeah, that money didn't really do anything for me. Why what was the point of that? Because yeah, we had a little bit more to use for down payment from the house, but it's still a form of forced savings. And it just at that age, it didn't make any sense. Like I hope to be kind of mortgage free by retirement, I guess. But you could try to time that, but it didn't really seem to help me much at all by paying it off early. And I probably could have used that money for something else that would have been better suited to my circumstances. All right. Makes next sense. Question.
I'm from the generation that doesn't have to worry about any of this, you know, because houses are completely unaffordable now. So, yeah.
Yes. It's time to destroy capitalism.
Not bitter.
No, not at all.
Hey, up next we have a question from Omar. I live in El Paso, Texas, making around $170,000 a year, which is considered a decent salary in this low cost of living area, which allowed me to save up and buy a house at 27. However, I'm still 29. El Paso is in the middle of nowhere, and flights are very expensive out of here. The quality of life is not great compared to bigger metro areas like New York City, where it's easier to find like-minded, career-driven friends. For instance, no one in my friend circle here would know about your podcast or be interested in it. That's a little hurtful. And there is definitely not much room for
a big El Paso following, apparently.
Yeah. And there is definitely not much room for bigger career opportunities here. And don't even get me started on the dating life. Given the high cost of living in a place like New York City, I know I'd be taking a pay cut no matter what based on the cost of living. Is it a stupid decision to move? Or is it better to sacrifice a few more years being here in order to build up savings and then move on with my life?
All right. First of all, Omar deserved a not to brag in here too. He said 170 grand in El Paso, Texas was a decent salary.
Yeah, that's
Omar, you're doing, yeah. So he's what, 29 years old, he said? I looked this up, 170K in El Paso. The median household income in that city is $55,000. 170,000 puts you in the top 10% of incomes in your city. You're doing, and you're 29, you own a home, you're doing great. So stop worrying about your finances. Yeah. If you're doing amazing. This is the problem with the internet. People who are objectively doing good with their finances look at other people doing better than them and go, I'm not that rich.
Right.
This guy's not even 30 and he's doing fantastic. So stop worrying about your finances. You're doing great. You do it when you're young. Don't wait. Move to New York City or Austin or Chicago or Seattle or Denver or San Francisco or Nashville or Charlotte or somewhere else. Just go. If your social life is suffering because of this, who cares what the finances are? Is that extra $100,000 going to really matter to you or whatever it is that you can save?
Yeah.
Do this while you're young now. You already own a home. Maybe sell or you can rent it out. Like, don't waste your youth. You won't regret doing this in the future. And guess what? You can always move back if you don't like it or it's too expensive. You're young, you're ambitious, good with your finances. You listen to podcasts like this. And you know in the back of your mind that you should move somewhere else. Just do it. What are you waiting for? Go. Get out of it.
No, I agree. Yeah, I know I've used this quote on the show before, but I always think of a John Lennon quote, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. This is like an example of that. Like, yeah, why would you put off living your life to save up some more money?
Especially when you're young, and you're not tied down by responsibilities yet. Like, now is the time to do that.
Yeah.
Get out of El Paso.
Now, I will just say, as someone who's lived in New York City, just maybe like hang out here for a bit, you know, do some trips up here before you just move here. Because talking about quality of life, there are a lot of people in New York City who would argue that the quality of life here in a lot of ways is not better than it would be in somewhere else.
I would visit. I would visit a few places first. I wouldn't be, don't make a quick move. You could move around a little bit too, but I would check a few places out before you decide to pick up and move everything.
Right. Yeah, right. Use some of that money that you've amassed to, you know, have fun in some different places.
Yeah, one more question. We'll get into some live chat ones.
Okay. Last but not least, we have, is investing in home builders the best way to play real estate without buying physical property?
Short answer, no. Long answer, John, chart on.
I thought you were going to say buy Zillow.
All right, so I plotted, it hasn't worked out for me, housing prices versus home builder stocks for the last 10 years, 2014 through 2023. The blue is home builder stocks. That's XHB is the ETF. And then the orange is Case-Shiller National Index. It's kind of funny to think. So in 2019, housing prices were up 3.6%. Like, no one had any clue it was coming for the next few years. But look at how crazy all over the place home builder stocks are. They're everywhere, all over the place, right? So we talked before how it's difficult to calculate your actual returns on housing, but this really isn't a good proxy. I mean, I guess you could say owning rentals might be close, but trying to throw up the next chart here. This is home builders versus the S&P. Home builders are barely outperforming over the past 10 years, but it's close. So home builder stocks
never have guessed that.
Yeah, it acts like this. Isn't it kind of crazy? We had the biggest real estate boom of our lifetime, and home builder stocks are barely just now outperforming over the last 10 years. I think if you look at the last 3-5 years, it'd be better. But home builder stocks will act like the stock market. So unfortunately, there really isn't a good proxy for investing. Like, but that's the point. We talked before how it's so unique, the whole experience of owning a home and the consumption behind it. And so I don't really think you can, you know, REITs aren't a really good one. REITs act like the stock market too. They act a little different than the stock market, but besides owning a home, and maybe if you don't own, I don't think you want to really, it's hard to replicate that. And maybe you don't want to because there's so much consumption and spending and expenses involved. Maybe you're probably better off just barbelling with cash in the stock market or bonds or whatever it is. It's, and not trying to replicate the housing market. It's too difficult, unfortunately. And there, I don't think that's ever going to be a case where you're going to be, say, I want to buy a piece of every home in America. It doesn't really work like that.
Yeah, this is a hot topic though. You see all these apps, all these platforms that allow you to have fractional, you know, ownership in a bunch of different places. There's that one that lets you have like vacation homes where you own it with 10 other people, and so you each get it for different periods of time throughout the year.
Yes,
people are into this.
That's called a timeshare.
This is like a modern take on it. Yeah.
The new thing is, yes, it's what, isn't it like how escargot, if it was called snails, no one would eat it, but it's called escargot. So instead of a timeshare, because timeshare has a bad, it's, you know, doesn't sound great. So now we call it fractional ownership.
The difference is with a timeshare, if they sell like the property, you don't get anything, right? Whereas with this, like you actually get some of the proceeds, I think is the idea. So you kind of actually own it.
I see a couple questions in here. Let me know if you see any. One said, what should a retired person's 401k look like? We have half in single stocks and half in CDs. I don't love single stocks for a retired person, honestly, because I don't want you to be spending all your time managing the stock market. If you're buy and hold, that's fine. But I don't want you to worry about your portfolio all the time. I want you out doing stuff, spending money, enjoying yourself. So I'd say if you like it, if that's a hobby, great. But otherwise, pick some mutual funds and ETFs.
That's what you call a barbell, right? CDs and single stocks.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, CDs is not a bad, that's not a bad way to do it.
Let's see. We have another one here from Dave, I think. Why use traditional IRA if it converts LTCG to ordinary income and 10% penalty to access money before 59 versus brokerage account? Better access to money and get that's capital gains, long-term capital gains tax. What about that one?
My whole thing is if you're thinking that niche where you're splitting hairs, either way, you're going to be fine. Right?
Okay.
I know they want a better answer, but I think either way, you're going to be fine. Someone else said, should Costco be the only stock in my portfolio? My wife went to Costco today.
Right?
I don't think my wife makes it out of Costco without spending $250. So maybe based on our spending habits, sure. All right. Should I worry about putting my cash on Coinbase in USD earning 5.5%? Well, that stuff didn't end very well last time. I'll say that. I look at that as like a junky junk bond kind of yield. Like it's very high yield. The default risk is very high. So you get the higher yield, but you have higher risk as well.
I saw Robinhood is taking yields on cash from 1.5% down to like 5 basis points or something. So I don't know if that's an indicator of anything, but.
Well,
on my account,
they earn their spread, so they still pay 4 or 5% in cash on brokerage, but they charge like 9% in margin debt.
We've got a good one here from Giancarlo. What was the best or favorite meal Ben had in Italy?
Oh, I mean, I ate a ton of pasta, just amazing pasta there.
Do you have like a favorite shape of pasta? I don't know all the different names, but do you have one?
Yeah, no, not really. It didn't, but just, yes, I had so much, and all the food there is just fresher. So everything just seemed fresh. The fruit and the, everything, that's one of the things I noticed about being in Europe is just very, everything was fresh.
All right. One more. Dave, also good follow-up here. What's your top favorite, what's your top three beers?
Oh, geez. Well, that's circumstantial, like just like investing. So in the summer, it's an Oberon with an orange. Right?
That's
but in
good.
The winter, it could be, you know, one of those winter ales. In the spring and the fall, it's circumstantial. I change my beer drinking habits based on the season.
I'm a big local person. If I'm traveling, I'll try to get something local.
Yes, if you go to a place and the name of the bar is the beer, like they have a beer that's named after the bar or the restaurant, you have to drink that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Oh, local whatever brewery.
I'm a big Hoegaarden person too. I like that. Those wheat beers, those are good. Yeah.
Not bad. All right. Thanks to everyone in the live chat for joining. As always, keep leaving your questions there. We'll grab them. Leave a question for us on YouTube. As always, I always go through the comments. Appreciate all that. We'll be back next week with a guest.
With a Hoegaarden sponsorship.
Next week. I like it. Like, rate, review, all that stuff. AskTheCompoundShow@gmail.com. That is our email address. Remember, sign up for the Compound Insider newsletter. Leave us a question or comment anytime you want. YouTube comments, email, live chat. We'll see you next time.
See everyone.
Thanks for listening to Ask the Compound. All opinions expressed by Ben Carlson, Duncan Hill, and any of their guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.